Call you
first.
Thank you, sir.
Sure.
Good morning, everyone.
Morning.
All right. Well, I am in the missions team with Lucas, and so a couple weeks back after a missions team meeting, I said, hey, do you need anyone to teach? I know you're going to be preaching. And he said, sure, go right ahead. Normally, I'm across the way on the next hour in Kevin's class. I facilitate and teach in there. So I'm glad you guys would have me. I am a student at Dallas Theological Seminary, and I'm halfway through my degree. I'm in the THM, which is the never-ending master's degree. It's 4 years and 120 credit hours. So I'm about 60 credit hours in right now. So hopefully I'll be done soon. And then I want to do a PhD. So I still won't be done. But I'm originally from Virginia, the Central Virginia area, and so I'm married, been married about 3 years, and this weather is right at home for me. This is what fall should be like. So,
is it your wife, the pretty girl that sings with dark brown hair?
That would be my wife,
yeah.
The pretty girl with curly brown hair that sings.
Yes.
That would be her.
That's an interesting way to put it.
Yeah,
that was a nice way to put it. I appreciate that. So, all right, that's a little bit about me. So you know me, and I want to talk today about Proverbs. Proverbs 21:31. We're going to spend the entire time today on one proverb. How is that?
Sounds great.
Sounds a little crazy. All right. So let me start with a story, okay? So there I was on a beautiful Jeju-do Island, which is the Hawaii of Asia. On my left side was Nelson, on my right side was Nathan on longboards. I was on my nice, new, shiny blue bike. It was a Saturday afternoon, and we were just chilling. We were riding some back roads, enjoying the weather, enjoying our time. The problem was the road we were on got a little more steep as we were going along. Nelson and Nathan said, I'm out. So they jumped off their longboards, grabbed a longboard, and walked back to the van. And I yelled back at them, all right, I'll see you guys back at the car. So I hunkered down and pedaled hard, and I thought, check this out, suckers. So I went around a few more corners and picked up speed even more. I came around one particularly sharp corner, and I knew at that very moment that I had made a mistake. I looked, and the road was incredibly steep, and at the bottom was a 4-foot concrete barrier that the road T-boned into, and it went all the way across the road. I was like, oh boy, okay. So I did the only logical thing to do. I hit my brakes as hard as I could. I had failed to do one thing. That was fix my brakes. I knew my brakes were broken, and I never fixed them. And so it did nothing to slow my pace whatsoever. Pause. So at that moment, I made a big mistake. I knew my brakes didn't work, but I failed to prepare. I'll come back and pick up the story a little later, but I don't think for us here in Dallas, Texas, that preparation is usually the issue. For us, usually we spend umpteen hours preparing, thinking through our future, thinking through how we want things to go. Our problem, I think, is that somewhere along the way, we get this idea that our success in life comes from our own ability to produce, our own skills, our own knowledge. But moments like that moment of panic remind us who's really in charge. You can bet at that moment when I hit those brakes, the one thing I was doing was praying, because I had made a big mistake. So I want to talk today about preparation. But I also want to talk today about the resting place for a successful life. I want to ask the question, where did the ancient sage find success? So that's where we're going to delve into Proverbs a little bit. I want to take that and kind of pull some theology out of that. So where do the people of God always find success? And then I want to kind of bring it down to our level, where we're at today, and how can we find true success. So turn to Proverbs 21:31, if you would, with me. Very brief proverb. It says, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory belongs to the Lord. All right? The horse is prepared for the day of battle, but victory belongs with the Lord. So let's go back then. How can we get this into Israel's context? I want to give you a little information about kind of their mission, about how this applied to them and what this meant to them. So I also like discussion, so I'm going to pause at certain times to see if you guys have any questions or statements or want to wrestle with the text as well, okay? I'll try to pause between each of kind of the major sections. So the point is, Israel must find their success in God, not in implements of war. So what's the context for this whole war thing? Well, God gave the land of Israel to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, right? They were given this land, but they were also given a responsibility to go in and to take the land. All right? But in this process, I think there was a temptation for Israel to base their success on numbers, on their ability, on skills in battle, and forget that it was the Lord who gives them success. I think sometimes when David gathered together Israel to fight, there was a sense in which if we have more numbers, if we are better at battle, we will succeed. But this proverb reminds Israel that it wasn't their ability that gave them success. It was only the Lord. I'm going to illustrate this with a couple passages. But first, the word horse in our text, the horse is prepared for the day of battle, that's actually a synecdoche, which means it's a part that stands for the whole. Meaning, horse stands for all of the implementation of battle. So, men, shields, bows, swords, all of those things that Israel does to get ready. So, in other words, Israel makes the proper preparation for this battle. That's the point. But the victory belongs to God. Let me give you a couple examples from Israel's history that tell a little bit about this. And you don't have to turn here, you can just listen. Deuteronomy 20 says this: when you go out to war against your enemies, and you see horses and chariots and an army larger than your own, you shall not be afraid of them. For the Lord your God is with you, who brought you up out of the land of Egypt. And when you draw near to battle, the priest shall come forward and speak to the people and say, "Hear, O Israel, drawing near to battle, do not fear or panic or be in dread." So do you see, the point I'm making is when Israel goes to battle, their confidence is in him and not in their own abilities. That's the point I'm making. Now, lest you think this was an easy thing to do, I want to read to you a story from Joshua when Israel actually had to apply this principle. Joshua 11:3 says this, and it's talking about all the enemies of Israel that gathered together to fight them. It says, "The Canaanites in the east, the Hittites, the Perizzites, the Jebusites in the hill country, the Hivites under Hermon, the land of Mizpah, they came out with all their troops, a great horde in number, like sand that's on the seashore, with very many horses and chariots. All these kings joined together." This is basically what happened. There's a new guy on the block, that's Israel, and so all of the enemies that usually didn't like each other said, "I don't like this new guy. Let's all get together and wipe him out." So here's Joshua leading the people of Israel in battle, and all his enemies are gathered together. Did you hear the picture? Can you imagine that? Like sand on the seashore. Imagine staring out at their camp at night. You see them all gathered together, and you see the torches from their campsites, and you can't even distinguish one from another because there's so many of them. Can you imagine what that would feel like? How scared you would be? So Israel, I'm sure, is feeling this. They're feeling this fear. It's one of their first major testings in battle. Is the Lord going to come through? And verse 6 in Joshua 11 says this, "And the Lord said to Joshua," I love this, he says, "do not be afraid of them." I think there was a real fear that Joshua would have and the people of Israel would have. He says, "do not be afraid of them, for tomorrow at this time, I will give them over." The point is, Israel was dependent upon God for success in their endeavor. It wasn't their abilities in war, because they didn't have any. wasn't that they were tested, hardened soldiers, because they weren't. Their confidence was in him and in God giving that victory. All right, so that's kind of their context. What principles can we draw out of this that are true for all time? So I want to go from Israel's context, what's true for all time, and then I want to come down to our context. So what's true for all time from this? Well, I think what's true from this situation is that the faithful from all generations must rest securely in God for success. So the faithful from any generation are given a task. That's why we're here on the earth. Moses had a task. David had a task. Take it to New Testament. Paul had a task, a reason that he was here on the earth. But unfortunately, with that task, I think the people of God are always tempted to carry out this task in their own strength, and in their own abilities, and their own wisdom. Let me give you a couple examples. I said Moses. How about Moses? What a faithful servant of God throughout his life. A great representative of the people of Israel. But unfortunately, Moses, near the end of his life, he was leading Israel, and they came to a point where the people were just bothering him, as they always do. They were being difficult, and Hebrew calls it stiff-necked. I love that. I love that word picture. They were not an easy people to lead. And so Moses was frustrated with them, and God said, speak to the rock, and it will give water to the people of Israel. And what did Moses do? He hit the rock. But I think where Moses went wrong was what he said afterwards. I think that's the point of why God was mad at him. He said, look, O Israel, what we have brought forth. Who's this we, Moses? Who's this we? That was God's work. Don't confuse yourself with God. And I think at that point, Moses was putting himself in the place of God and saying, look what I provided for you, Israel. Unfortunately for Moses, there were consequences and he wasn't able to go into the promised land. Now, I want to give Moses a little grace, though. If I were leading the people of Israel and I had a staff, I don't think rocks would be what I'd be striking. You know what I'm saying? All right, I want to pause and make sure that you're tracking with me and see if you have any questions about what I've said so far. Does that make sense? Yes? No? Maybe? Questions? Or thoughts? Uh-huh.
I have an observation.
Uh-huh, sure.
It's in the form of a question, I don't know, but speaking of God providing, and in this instance, Moses actually doing it on God's behalf to provide for the people, whereas God could easily have just provided for the people without Moses in between.
Mm.
And likewise with the preparation for battle, even though God would see that the enemies would be defeated, they still had to go into battle and do for themselves to a certain degree. I just wonder if you could speak on that.
Well, I think the point is that God is taking a people who are small and insignificant and unknown, and he is teaching them. He is changing them. He is making them into something that they are not. And part of that process involves them responding to him. And God is entering into a covenant with the people Israel, and he's teaching them to be faithful, a little bit at a time. So he says to Israel when he first brings them out of Egypt, you're not ready to go fight yet. If you fought Egypt right now, you would leave, you would stop. He says, I need to take you step by step and train you in order to bring you to where you're ready. I think he's looking for a people that are going to be faithful to him.
So it's a message of faithfulness and, perseverance and obedience more than anything.
Yes, yes. And in Hebrew, to listen means to obey. If you hear someone in the Hebrew language, that doesn't mean that your ears are working correctly. That means that you're obeying what they say. And I think that informs a little bit of what Jesus says when he says, he who has ears, let him hear. I don't think Jesus is talking about our capacity to hear. He's saying, I'm looking for a people who will obey what I say. Other questions?
Are you going to go into how it looks for us?
That's my hope.
Okay. I'll ask that question to anybody, but I won't ask it. You're going to ask it.
That's where I'm going.
Great.
Next. Once we get through the theology of it. All right. So I'm talking about the theology, which is always, okay? The people of God always have a mission, and there's always a temptation to carry that out in their own strength. That's what I'm saying right now. I gave you the example of Moses. How about David? Near the end of his life, do you remember what David did? And the people of God faced the consequences. I think what was happening in David's mind near the end of his life is he saw all of his enemies, and I think he began to fear. He began to fear that all of these numbers would overtake the people of Israel. And he began to ask, are we strong enough to fight all of these people? So do you remember what he did?
He did a muster.
A muster. A census. And I think it's so fascinating. Joab tells him this is a bad idea. All right, Joab? You know, Joab has not exactly got his head on straight. That guy is not a good guy in the story. And when Joab is telling you you're doing something immoral, you probably need to pay attention. And do you remember what Joab said? Don't do this. Our confidence is in God. That's what Joab tells David. Like, whoa. David decides to go ahead with this census, and there were consequences for the people of Israel because David desired to place his confidence in numbers instead of in the Lord. There's always a temptation for the people of God to carry out their ministry in their own strength. And what about a New Testament example? I thought of Peter. Always good for an example. Good or bad. So Peter was ministering primarily in Jerusalem. And you know, one of the biggest issues in the early church were racial issues, interestingly enough. The Jews and the non-Jews, or the Jews and the Gentiles. And what began to happen was Peter aligned himself with the Judaizers and those who were of Jewish origin and began to shun Gentiles. Do you remember in Galatians when Paul says, I came to Peter and I confronted him in public, to his face? That would have been an awkward time. Can you imagine Sunday school class if Andy comes in and like calls Lucas out on something right in front of everyone? That'd be kind of awkward. But Paul says, I called him out because he was clearly wrong. What Peter was doing in that moment, he was caring more about what other people thought, and he was bowing to these pressures of the Judaizers instead of carrying out his ministry in the power of the Lord. I think that's what began to happen. I think Peter got it straight. I think he turned around, but there's always a temptation that we, as the people of God, would fulfill our ministry, our calling, our purpose in life in a way that displeases God. So pause again. Questions, thoughts, or comments? Are you tracking with me? All right, seeing nods. Any questions? I really don't mind. I like questions.
Well, if thinking in absolute terms,
mm-hmm.
then could you say that if you do have lots of resources and such, that it isn't glorifying to God, or that you should purposely put yourself in a place where you don't have things that you could put your confidence in?
I think what I've done is I've created tension by not defining the word success. And I did that on purpose. When we take that to our context today, I think it's important to realize that success is defined and empowered by God. I don't think that necessarily means that those who have means and have resources ought to feel bad about that. God has used people of means throughout the history of the church and throughout the history of the Old Testament as well to empower and help others. And I think we're asking about an orientation, inward or outward orientation, regardless of the means that someone has. And I define success as a life changed by God, loving and serving others. And I think that's regardless of the amount or the means. Sir, I'm sorry. Right here.
I was just going to say, including not trying to determine in your own mind how God should be working or using or blessing or challenging somebody else.
Hmm.
With what's going on in your life. Mm-hmm. I mean, it can be really easy and comforting to judge somebody else because of how the kids behave or don't behave. Or just something that makes you feel more comfortable because that's a good area for you.
Mm-hmm.
So to step back and not assume what somebody else's life should look like.
And there's always a temptation, I think, in the church that we desire uniformity instead of unity. And from the very beginning, the church has been about unity and not necessarily uniformity. I think you had your hand up a little earlier, then we'll come back here.
I was going to say, I really like the word orientation that you used, because I think the key is our orientation has to be towards God first. And then when everything we do, first seeking His will, and then wherever we end up is His will, and whatever comes along with that, theoretically, is part of His will. Then it doesn't matter if we're rich or poor or whatever, He's put us in that particular situation so that we can glorify Him to those that are around us and use those resources to glorify Him. And I think, like, I personally, sometimes I get into a situation, I'm like, okay, what am I going to do here? And I forget to ask God first. And I see, like, once I started paying attention to this, it's amazing to me how many instances in my life, just daily life, that this plays out where I try to do it on my own, and I'm, like, really frustrated. And then I'm like, wait a second, I need to step back here. Maybe I'm frustrated because I'm trying to do it on my own, and I'll stop and say a little prayer, and sometimes, it's literally right there that it changes, but sometimes it's, but when I have started trying to pay attention to that, it's amazing to me how many times in my life that things shift once I stop trying to do it myself and ask God what I'm supposed to do.
Sir, do you have a question or a statement?
Speaking to you or judging others, you don't look at symptoms, you look at the heart orientation. And if that's the heart orientation isn't connected to Christ, like the fruit of the vine, then there's not as a brother. Of course, I have children in my life, and I can look at the vine. If I am, if that's what my heart and my brother or sister would be, they'd be the same because that's where joy is, that's where the fruit of the spirit is, if you're not connected. And at that point, it is my responsibility to enter the body, love it, probably direct it to connect to God.
And I think that's the point of the church coming together, is that together we can assist and help one another. But I tell you, it's hard to get into people's lives and as a friend. It's hard to talk into people's lives that need it. And that takes kind of a special relationship. So I want to move on here to an application of how this applies to us. But before I do, in my notes, I have one more passage that illustrates this. It's another proverb. Proverb 3, 4, and 5. Do you want to go into that, or should we go to application? I'll let you choose. Which one should we do? Do you want to hear something about Proverbs 3, 4, and 5? a little more information, a little reinterpretation?
We want both.
Both? Oh, man.
Yeah, just shorten them.
Yeah, just get more efficient.
More efficient? I'm telling you, man.
Success, buddy. Success.
Oh, wow, man.
Way to go, September.
Rough.
Well, I have application error. We'll just get all hitched.
All right. So I think a proverb that illustrates this is Proverbs 3, 4, and 5. You know it. I don't even have to turn to it. Can someone quote it to me? I know you know it.
Get us started.
What was that? Get us started.
Do not trust.
Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways.
Acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight.
He will make your path straight, okay? Do not lean on your own understanding. In all your ways, acknowledge him, and he will make your path straight. I think the word acknowledge there is a little unfortunate. It used to mean, I think in the KJV, something that it didn't, that it doesn't nowadays. Nowadays, it kind of sounds like a nod of the head, right? Like if you acknowledge God, it's like, oh yeah, God is there. That's not what it means. The Hebrew word is yada, which means to know. But as I said before, it's not about this mental knowledge. I want to show you something cool. And this is in 1 Samuel 2:12. And this is talking about Eli's sons. You know those guys, they were priests, but they were not very good priests. In fact, they were kind of terrible priests. Now, the sons of Eli were worthless men. They did not know God. Wait a minute, these guys are priests. They're in the temple 24/7. That's their job. Of course they know God. Of course they know him. Hebrew's not talking about a mental ascent. Hebrew is talking about a life submitted to God, a bowing of the knee to the Lord. This is an acknowledgement of the lordship of God. And Eli's sons, they don't know God. They don't follow him. Jeremiah 22:16, I want to turn there real quick, gives another illustration of how Hebrews, how they think about this word, know. I probably should have had this marked out before so I don't have to take time turning. I need to be more efficient. All right. So let me read this to you. Do you think you're a king because you compete in Seder? Did not your fathers eat and drink and do righteousness and justice, and then it was well with them? They judged the poor and needy, then it was well. Is this not to know me? The Israeli kings were tempted to think they were great because of their economic prowess. They were selling cedars, making money like a boss. But God says, no, your fathers did justice. They loved the poor. That's what it means to know me. What he's meaning is, if you know God and you have bowed the knee to him, his priorities will be your priorities. All right, I've gone down a little side trail, so let me bring you back. The point of Proverbs 3, 4, and 5 is that if our life is submitted to him, it will be successful. Hebrew says, he will make your way straight. That's a Hebrew, a phrase? Idiom, that's the word I was looking for. That's a Hebrew idiom for success. A straight way, a straight path. God will make your way straight if your life is submitted to him. But I said it before, the definition and the power for success come from him. So let's apply this real quick. My imperative today is to rest your life solely upon the Lord, not on your own skills and knowledge. And I think that's a temptation for us in Dallas, is to rest our life in our own ability to produce, in our own intelligence, and not in him. We're here because we have a purpose and a reason. Just like the people of Israel, just like the people of God from all times, we're on this earth for a purpose. You can call that your ministry if you want, your calling, your reason. You each, I know, and am very confident, are gifted in ways that I could never imagine. You have skills. You have knowledge. you've worked hard to be in a place where you can be productive. And I think it's not too much to assume that your desire is that you would be successful for the Lord, each in your own field. But the American culture teaches us to rest our life in our own ability, doesn't it? The American culture teaches us to produce. And then once we've produced, to look at what we've produced and be proud of our own accomplishments. I think that's how the American culture is oriented. So I'm going to close with just a couple illustrations. Lean into the opportunities that God gives you to rest your life in Him. Lean into those opportunities. Let me suggest what a couple of those might be. It might look something like family problems. I went back home. I said I'm from Virginia. I went back home this summer after 2 years, and some of those secret sins of my family that used to be on the inside were coming out and were tearing apart members of my family. And I'm sitting at Starbucks around this round table with one of the members of my family, and they're mad at God. And by default, they're mad at me because I'm in seminary. And by default, they're mad at me because they know of my position. And so they level accusations at God and level accusations at me. And in that moment, I realized 2 years of seminary has not helped me at all. I have no idea what to say. I have no idea what the right response is to them. And in that moment, it's like that moment on my bike where it's like, Lord, I don't know what to say. Would you minister in this situation? Would you give me the words to say? Have you ever been in a situation kind of like that? I think those are the moments when God is teaching us, look, it's not about your abilities. It's not about what you can do. I'm the one that gives you the strength, that gives you the wisdom. How about health problems in your family or yourself? I got a call this past summer that my mom has a degenerative lung disease. We knew that, but we didn't know that she only had about 5 years left if something drastic doesn't change. She has interstitial lung disease, as well as some other issues. And at moments like that, when I got that call, it reminded me, Lord, I can do my best. I can get great grades. I can produce. I can make money. But real healing, real power only comes from you. I think these are the things, these crises that God brings in our life is teaching us. It's Him. He is the one that provides the definition and the power for true success. All right, let me pause there. We got a few minutes. Questions, statements. Yes, ma'am.
I think there's a situation that I see in myself and meeting others who relate to it. God gives us these gifts and these competencies, and it's really easy to go out and be competent. I mean, go competent in this situation, like a verb out there. Competent in this situation. And the very gifts that we've been given become the God and the dependency they were never meant to be, because it's easy. God made me smart, God made me a hard worker, God made me an organizer. You know, whatever your thing is. But if the posture of our heart every morning is God, you know, I surrender to you this day. I want to be in step with your purposes. Keep me mindful of you and choose to be mindful of you. Because part of that's the discipline of our spirit, too.
Mm.
That I could draw on you and go your way in this different situation. And I don't even know what happened today. Whatever it's got out there, I want to do it your way.
Mm-hmm.
I think that kind of posture of the heart sets you up, and that's the regular characterization of your life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm definitely in process. I think it prepares you better for those harder, more intense times. It's just making it darn clear that you need him every moment.
Mm-hmm. Well said. Well said. A posture of the heart daily.
Could we say this is the biblical explanation of the circle? And it says comfort zone, and then out here is success, and that we should make choices that purposely put us in a place of discomfort so that we rest on him. I'm not saying, like, sell your house and live on the street tomorrow. I'm just saying don't do things just because they're comfortable. Like, maybe even choose to seek out things that would grow you and make you a little have to trust him more.
And that's hard, I think, because our culture, comfort is really the orientation of our culture. We make money so that we can be more comfortable. We get more things around us so that we cannot be inconvenienced. And these things, in some sense, take over the position of a God that we need to depend upon. Excuse me. Yes, ma'am. I think you had your hand up first.
First of all, let's just be in a comfy one. Definitely agree. But like she said, you know, I think some people do take it to the extreme. The only way to serve God is if I'm broke, so that it looks like I'm not.
Right.
And a part that really helps me outside of scripture was to never let your standard of living exceed your standard of giving. Because even if you are just extremely wealthy, God doesn't say that to sin as long as your heart is right. So some of the most wealthy people can make the most change because they have the means. So especially like when you would look at those lot, you know, in this area, there is wealth, and that's not a sin. But is there a giving
the Yes. And I tell you, where I'm from, I'm a redneck from a little town in Virginia. No joke. I have never been exposed to people that have means like they do in Dallas. But I have been blown away by the heart of people in this church and at DTS that have money. But God has been moving them to a place of graciousness. And if I can say it, I have a lot of family members that don't have very much at all, but they're still very, you know, they're tight. They're not gracious. And I think, you know, some people the Lord allows to have great success, I think, because he knows they are worthy of this entrustment. That's not across the board, but I think sometimes that's a situation. We have time for one more comment, then we'll close.
I was going to say, so yes, we don't want to always choose the comfortable, but I think even sometimes using that word, should I choose this, that even underlying that is, well, it's me choosing it. It's not God choosing it. And so what I've tried to focus on is letting God choose those things for me, because he knows in what ways I need to be tested and uncomfortable to rid myself of me and let him fill me with him more.
I agree with James, really, because I think and wholeheartedly, because a lot of times us as humans, some of us like to choose the hard way, like don't like comfort or contentment, but we only put ourselves in those positions so that we can take those skills that we think we're the best at and apply them. It's more of a self-confidence thing, but it's all lying on our own. And I love what James says, because if we let God choose comfort, discomfort, however it goes, we don't set ourselves up where we're going to feel good. This is a comfort thing for me at the end of the day because I was able to use this skill that overcomes a challenge, right? I think there's a really slippery slope in purposely choosing that discomfort or having a choice whatsoever. I mean, I think the purposeful heart.
Oh man, we're getting discussion going now.
Yeah. But the same, and kind of the same thing, I know as I've been an entrepreneur, and especially in the church, you're people, oh, if it's God's will, he'll just open the way and it'll be super easy.
No.
Or, but then they also say, oh, well, you're having a hard time because Satan's after you. It's like, you can't just go by, does it look easy, does it look hard? Mm. That doesn't help you. That, you know, you really do have to kind of give it to God, because people will say both ways.
Well said, and I would suggest that discerning where God is moving is the tension point in these kind of decisions. What is it that God wants me to do? But I'm okay with a little tension. So I'll close. So there I was, all right? I hit my brakes, nothing happened. I thought two thoughts. Okay, can I throw my bike down and then at least skid and maybe just smack into the wall? No, that's not going to help because then I'm going to break my leg and I'm going to have to go to Green Hospital and I don't know what Green doctors do. I don't want to do that. So then I thought, can I jump off my bike? I was like, no, you can't jump off your bike. You don't have anything to push off with. All right, so what am I going to do? Those two thoughts went through my mind. Wham! I smacked into the wall at about 20 miles an hour. I went flying over top of the wall by some miracle. I have no idea. The only part of me that touched the wall was my hand. I touched it as I went over. The only reason I know is because I had a scrape on my hand. That was it. I landed on my back. I was looking up, and all I saw was blue sky. And I seriously, my first thought was, am I in heaven? I got up, and I looked at myself. I was like, nope, this is the same body I had before. I'm not in heaven. I went around, grabbed my bike, and put it on my back. All that was left was a crumpled can of a bike. And I remember thinking, my first thought was, thank you, God. You protected me. You provided. Thank you. And I think that ought to be our position in life, is saying, thank you, God. It wasn't my skill. It wasn't my ability. It's only you.